mentioned in dispatches, this is season 7, and I've lost track of what episode number we're on. I think it's 7. It might be 8. I'm not even all that well lubricated, and I've lost track of the numbers. My first guest tonight is a little lubricated, given his previous appearance this evening elsewhere. Noted author and game designer Matt Forbeck is joining us for the first time on Mentioned in Dispatches. Matt, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Brent. Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this is, I think, the first time we've ever had a father and son combo on Mentioned in Dispatches. Matt's son, Marty, is joining us. Marty, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well.
All right. Probably not as lubed up as your dad, though, huh?
Marginally less so.
Partially, light years.
Yeah. The reason we've got Matt and Marty on the podcast, Matt's got a Kickstarter coming up for the next Shotguns and Sorcery book. And we've talked to Matt before on previous podcasts about some of the Shotguns and Sorcery stuff, but this is a new product. So this is taking Shotguns and Sorcery into the fifth edition system, correct?
Exactly. Shotguns and Sorcery actually started out many, many years ago, like 20 years ago, as a third edition setting, right? So back in the day, Wizards of the Coast actually was doing a third edition world hunt. They said, everybody wants to turn in a one-page proposal for a world setting, and then we'll decide what we think is the best, and we'll narrow it down. It'll be like, you know, world setting idol going on, and then somebody's going to become the winner of them all and slaughter the others and blah, blah, blah.
And that's where Eberron came out of, right?
That's exactly where Eberron came from, which is Keith Baker is a good buddy of mine. And Keith, actually, the funny part is the guys at Atlas Games about a year before that said, we have this new game designer is writing some stuff for us. His name's Keith Baker. Could you kind of mentor him into this? And then Keith comes in and lands that gig. I'm like, I can't take any credit for it. He did a great job, right? But I was like, oh, I'm happy I was there before this happened. I actually ended up writing a trilogy of Eberron novels with Keith. Keith wrote a trilogy. I wrote a trilogy at roughly the same time. They came out about the same time back when the role-playing or the setting first came out. But anyhow, one of the things that I had turned in for this, which was a one-page setting, was this thing called Shotguns and Sorcery. And then afterwards, I'm like, this idea wouldn't let me alone. So what I did is I turned around, I had left Pinnacle Entertainment Group, and I was doing my own stuff. And Marty was just a baby back then. And I was wandering around and said, I'm going to try to sell this to somebody. But I didn't want to just, sell them the idea. Like, you get a lot of times, you're just like, here's the property, whatever. So I said, I'm going to sell this to somebody, and then I'm going to license it to them, and they're going to then hire me to write this stuff, right? Which I thought was a great deal. I'm like, okay, I get money both ways. Good. And I actually had a bunch of nibbles on it. I was like, okay, these guys are good. These guys are good. And eventually I decided to go with Mongoose Publishing, made me a really good deal. And we're going to have a whole line of books for this. It was going to be a third edition stuff. And then my wife got pregnant with quadruplets. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to be doing this for a while. So I don't have any time to be doing personal stuff. I'm going to be lucky if I can get out of bed in the morning after I feed the kids at their 2 a.m. feeding. So we put this aside for a while. I ended up writing a short story for it for Robin Laws for an anthology he was doing, a fiction anthology. Mm-hmm. And I wrote one for the Origins fiction anthology after that. I really liked it. So I then wrote a trilogy of novels for this 12 for 12 this crazy project I did in 2012 where I tried to write a dozen novels in a year. And we broke them up into separate trilogies. The second trilogy was a Shotguns and Sorcery trilogy. That did really well. I had a lot of fun with it. I wrote three novels for it. We got tons of stories. And then this company, I can't remember the name, it's Noble Beast, says they want to do an enhanced ebook edition of this game, of this book. And I signed a license agreement with them. They did a thing called Steampunk Holmes. Like Steampunk Sherlock Holmes, gotten like $90,000 on Kickstarter for these enhanced ebooks that had animation and soundtracks and all sorts of other really cool stuff. Wow. And then they were going to run a second Kickstarter, and then Shotguns and Sorcery was going to be the third. And her second Kickstarter was for like 15 books that were riffs on things like anything from Sense and Sensibility to Peter Pan to Heart of Darkness, right?
Okay.
And it failed miserably.
Oh, geez.
it tanked so hard. I think they were looking for like $60,000. They were bringing in like five, right? Yeah. And they're like, well, we're going bankrupt. Nice knowing you. Forget the contract. But their VP of production was a guy named Jeremy Moeller, who was this fantastic artist. And he bugged me for 2 years saying, let's do something with this. And eventually I relented and said, okay, Jeremy, you want to do a role-playing game for this? I'll let you do a role-playing game. And I licensed Shotguns and Sorcery to him as a role-playing game. He did a Kickstarter in 2015. And they licensed the Cypher system from Monte Cook Games, right?
Yep.
And we hired Rob Schwalb, who did 4th and 5th edition work, and then also did the Shadow of the Demon Lord and all sorts of other great stuff. Rob's a fantastic designer. He did all the mechanics. I did all the background stuff. And Jeremy and his team did all the artwork. And then everything blew up for various reasons. The book didn't come out in time. We're finally just shipping the last bits of it right now. There's literally an art book that Marty and I have been working on that's coming out. I think we're going to ship to backers either at the end of this week or early next week. And then, because we like, well, we can't just let this sit here. We got this great property, all this artwork. I was like, Marty, are you interested in doing a 5th edition version of this? And we couldn't do that back when it came out because 5th edition wasn't in the OGL at that point, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, but now we can make it. We can turn it back to D&D. And I'm like, Marty, would you like to do that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, that was his answer. So
yeah,
that was enough for me to say, okay, we're going. And
said, yeah, whatever, Dad. Exactly. I guess I'll take a look.
So Marty reluctantly stepped up to the plate and smacked a home run out of the park. So it was so he's been working on the 5th edition version of it, doing new character class, new magic items, new monsters, all translated over from the Cypher system and the original setting before that, and just did a bang up job with it. One of the neat things about this is that we now have like 95% of the manuscript done. The only things that are missing are bits that I have to write, which are going to be new, some new fiction snippets, brand new stuff that's going to go in the game to illuminate the fiction setting and you know, the setting in general, so that people get excited about it. But Marty has done a great job with all the mechanics over. I'm really impressed with this. I'm basically serving as the developer, the line developer for it, and the editor, and I'm doing layout and stuff like that. We've got 95% of the artwork in. We've got a few new pieces went on commission. And Jeremy actually provided a brand new cover, which just showed up the other day, which is glorious, right? It's full color. The main characters in the novels being surrounded by zombies on all sides, fighting as darkness closes in on them. It's really dramatic and fun and beautiful. Like, well, you know, the problem with doing role-playing games these days is I don't really want to like come out with a role-playing game and then push it through distribution and put it in stores and... You know, am I really going to compete with Paizo and Wizards of the Coast doing this kind of stuff? I'm like, no. So we run a Kickstarter for this, right? We put it out there. We're going to see how many people are interested in it. And we're not planning to sell this in stores. We're basically, it's going to be a Kickstarter exclusive. Now, if somebody backs up a dump truck of money to my house, we will arrange to put this in stores. But the plan right now is to do a limited edition print run for the backers, which will include basically a regular book and then a high-end deluxe version, which is like, you know, leatherette, debossed, embossed, foil stamped, whatever the hell we can get away with as we knock down stretch goals throughout the campaign. And then we're done. We'll put it up as a PDF and print on demand after that. We'll sell off whatever extra copies we have from the print run. And then we'll move on to the next cool thing, whatever that happens to be. I don't think the game lines have to be game. You know, one of the things when I was working with Pinnacle, and I was one of the founders of Pinnacle Entertainment Group, was that it becomes this treadmill that you're on where you just have to keep putting out product and be able to feed the people who are doing this and to be able to feed that line. And yeah. I just don't want to do that with this. I want to do something very cool and get a lot of people excited over it. And then Marty and I will move on to the next cool thing, whatever that happens to be, right?
Yeah.
Or Marty will move on to whatever the hell he thinks it's cool to be, and I'll just be clapping on the sidelines. We'll figure that out.
One of the things that I learned in my brief time as a publisher is that lots of people think being a game designer is a lot of fun, and then being your own publisher means that you get full creative control of everything you're working on, and that's great. But what people don't realize is you very quickly figure out that you think you're in the game publishing business, and you're actually in the shipping business.
Yeah, exactly. I've told the story so many times, but inventory management has killed off more companies than I've seen in the industry than anything else, right? Every time somebody goes bankrupt, you go in, there's a warehouse full of shit that didn't sell for whatever reason, right? And a lot of times it was their best-selling stuff. And the problem is for their last print run, whatever it was, they way overprinted over whatever the demand happened to be. And then they spent years trying to sell it off, or, you know, 6 months, whatever. And then said, this is just never going to go unless some kind of a miracle happens. And, you know, we end up being featured on Critical Role or some television on HBO or whatever, you know, Stranger Things. Then maybe we'll sell this all. But otherwise, barring a miracle, we're screwed and we need to shut our doors.
So. Yeah. Yeah,
And I don't want to fall into that trap, right? I mean, that's one of the great things about PDF and print on demand is that you can actually hit the demand exactly as it is. And Kickstarter is a great way to judge that initial demand, right?
Yeah.
So when we figure out what that is through the Kickstarter, we'll print to that demand and a little bit over, because one of the things about printing is they always do either 10 or 5% over or under. So you always have to order at least 10% over to make sure you manage to get enough books, because there's always wastage and whatever else in these things. So we may end up with a couple hundred extra books or whatever. We'll sell those off whenever we can at conventions, online, whatever. But and then the rest of it will say, go to DriveThruRPG and pay for the print-on-demand cup. We won't make nearly the profits on that, but you'll still get a great goddamn book. It'll look beautiful. It won't look quite as cool and snazzy as the one we're selling on Kickstarter, mind you. So get on this now.
That's what you get for missing the Kickstarter.
Exactly. Yeah. And that way you manage to make sure that this really cool thing actually sees the light of day, right? Which is really the whole thing behind Kickstarter.
The Kickstarter stuff kind of cracks me up because there's a lot of people in the board game and tabletop game industry that are like, oh, wow, this is so awesome. You can crowdfund these things and find out if there's enough demand and then figure out how many you need to print and then have some left over to go sell. And us wargamers are over here kind of waving, from the sidelines going, we've been doing this shit since 1996.
Oh, God, yeah, right?
The war game companies figured out very early on that they can't afford to do 1,500 copy print runs of these, fairly complex to assemble board games and hope that they sell. So what they started doing were these P500 programs. There is nobody that's a war gamer listening to this podcast that doesn't know what I'm talking about. But for role-playing folks that, might be hopping on this podcast because of you guys, the war gamers figured out early on, hey, to print 500 copies of this, we need to charge X for the pre-orders. That'll get us 250 sold out the door. That leaves us the other 250 that we can sell at retail and double the money, however the math was going to work out. Basically, the people that pledged it ahead of time kind of got it at cost in order to cover the pre-charge on those shipping costs. So the Wargamers have been doing this crap since the midnight, since the Kickstarter founders were in junior high. The Wargamers figured it out. And what Kickstarter did was democratize that platform more than anything else. They created the platform that let everybody throw their P500 stuff up there. Yep. And everybody's like, wow, this is revolutionary. And the Wargamers are going, Jesus, this again? Like, we invented this shit 30 years before the rest of the world.
We did this shit by mail with stamps.
Yeah. And so, this is not new, but it's cool that everybody else sort of caught up with it. And so you're right. It has hugely changed the ability to produce these one-offs, to produce some really cool stuff for folks. And that coupled with the print on demand model keeps a lot of things in print that otherwise would have been dead in the water for years. It's completely screwed the collector's market, obviously, but the hell with them.
Well, the thing about the collector's market is that doesn't make the publisher or the creator a goddamn dime, right?
No.
I mean, it spurs demand, especially if you're doing collectible stuff, right? If you're doing like Pokemon or Magic the Gathering or whatever. But for the rest of us, when somebody resells that game or that copy of the game or the card or whatever, the publisher doesn't get any money for that, right?
Yeah.
If it's used stuff, it goes to the store or whoever's selling it. Which, more power to them. I'm a big fan of game stores staying open by any means necessary, but...
Yeah, but for a long time, a lot of those collectible things, those used things, that was the only way you could find a lot of those things because they weren't back available. We were talking a little bit off air, the Mastara game world that I've been, it's been sort of my home base world since I started role playing in the early 80s. And I've stuck with it forever. I'm missing one of the entire line of the Gazetteers that came out in the late 80s and early 90s. And I got them all off the rack when they were new. And for the longest time, you couldn't find those things. Now you've got print-on-demand copies available through DriveThruRPG, I think, or somebody. They're available as print-on-demand these days that you can get them again. But for the longest time, you couldn't. It was just no way to get them. And there's a couple of things that they still have never reprinted. You're never going to see the trail maps come back into print because it costs more to fold them than it does to print them.
Exactly. No, it's
These
things are
the size of a bed sheet. And that's not an exaggeration. They're the size of a bed sheet. I know. I laid one out on a bed one day to be able to look at the whole thing unfolded. Those things are never coming back into print. It's just not. It'd be cool if they did, but it's,
no, I remember I love those stuff, like the old gigantic maps. I used to take them to a company called Shield Laminating at Gen Con, right? And they would actually like press them between two plastic sheets and like iron them as they went through. So you'd have your Greyhawk map and then you had to roll them up because they wouldn't fold anymore or anything like that.
But, yeah.
Those are great days. I actually went down a rabbit hole trying to figure out what happened to Bob Bartels from Shield Laminating. I think he's running a store in Columbus, Ohio nowadays, or his family at least. So.
So Marty, Dad ropes you into this for the 5e work. How much of this was his idea? How much of this was your idea?
I'd say it was about 99.8% his idea.
So it was my idea to make Marty do all the work.
Yeah. The last 0.02% is just hot gas. There's a lot of my ideas in the book, but the initial idea for it was entirely, you know, hey, come over here, kid. I got something you might be interested in.
Yeah, but I mean, you had read some of the stories before, so I'm like, you know.
I'd read the novels. I'd read the role-playing game multiple times. I reread the novels before I really wrote all this. But you came to me with this.
Well, it's a special kind of torture to have to read your own dad's writing, I understand. But, you know.
I read way too much of it. I'm going to try not to read any of your books in the future because I'm too inundated with your style.
Then you start thinking, only if you pay me, Dad. That's how it works.
Yeah.
The old joke about it's only child labor if you pay them.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. You used to hand us manuscripts as kids and a red pen and be like, hey, if you notice anything. I didn't get paid for that.
You know, the kids had to love finding errors in what Dad wrote. You know, it's ha ha, gotcha. So
that's not wrong. That's a metaphor.
Yeah. So with all that, though, there was the assumption that you were at least passingly familiar with the setting itself. How much did you already know the game mechanics you were bringing to the table? How much of it were you inventing on the fly? How much of it was Dad saying, no, you're doing that all wrong?
There was a fair bit of no, you're doing that all wrong. But I just expect that from him on a daily basis. I've played D&D for, you know, over a decade now, and that's something given that I'm only 22. The shotguns and sorcery game, you know, I played the Cypher system a few times, so I was familiar with the basic mechanics, and I'd read the game, and I played around with the shotguns and sorcery based game a few times. I was pretty familiar with the game going in, and I was also familiar with the differences between the novels and the game. Because the game is not quite like the books. I think this version of the game is a little more like the books. All due respect and love to Rob Davio. He's great. And he wrote.
Rob Schwab. Thank you.
Rob Schwab. Rob Davio. Rob Schwab, who wrote the original Shotguns and Sorcery game. But it ironically, it was a little too much like D&D. Yeah. And now that we're bringing it to D&D, I think it's going to be a little less like D&D.
I think we get to embrace it. I'm sure there's somebody listening to this that's staring at their podcast player going, what the heck? But yeah, you know, I don't remember the exact context of the thing your dad was sharing online. This isn't your first game credit, though, is it?
Not quite. Not exactly. I mean, I helped my dad on various other things.
Yeah, you've done a bunch of stuff with the Cypher System game, right? You did Monsters and Mean Streets. You did a bunch of writing for that.
There isn't going to be much in the way of a supplemental stuff for this version planned, because in this fifth edition version, we're basically lumping in revisions of the supplemental stuff from the original Kickstarter, and I wrote a lot of that. I wrote Monsters and Mean Streets, which was the sort of monster manual type thing, which came with the original game. I wrote an adventure, which came with the original game. So I have previous credits on the system.
I think that's awesome. You know, in your early 20s, like I was still trying to figure out how to work the spell check on mine, you know, my computer. Never mind getting anywhere close to actually getting something in print. So I think that's really awesome. You know, I'm sure somebody out there is going to do that because your dad's famous, but who cares? You're doing the work. Like it's, you know.
Marty's been doing a lot of writing over the years. He's got a degree in film and video and creative writing from University of Wisconsin. He actually was writing for the school paper there, the Daily Cardinal, too. It's great stuff. So I felt very confident with handing this stuff
over. I did not do great stuff at the Daily Cardinal. Don't go look that up.
But you know, honestly, I've edited a lot of people over the years. Back when I was at Pinnacle, they would hand me stuff and I would hand it back to them and they'd say, who bled all over this manuscript, right? It's just, it's terrifying. And Marty does a great job. He actually does. He's a very good writer. I say it with some confidence. And, you know, like every young writer, I'm always like, well, this could be like this, but that's really my way, not your way. You get to do it your way. Although I'm cutting the checks here, so do it my way. right? That's how it works. But for this kind of stuff, he's probably played more fifth edition than I have over the years. And it's just kind of need to be able to see him take it and interpret the way he's doing it and see how his mind works as opposed to the way I would do it myself. And one of the things I learned early on as an editor is that you don't need to impose your own ideas on your writers. You need to let them breathe and do their own thing and try to polish the thing so they actually have the best versions of what they've created. And hopefully I've been trying to do that with Marty as well. I'm not trying to force him too much down one lane that sounds too much like me, right? He's got his own tone and his own style. I really enjoy it, so I'm excited to see more of it.
Yeah, I think that's something that a lot of people have trouble distinguishing between the idea of an editor versus a copy editor. Right? They think the editor's just chasing around stray commas and moving apostrophes out of the way. And there's a lot more to it in terms of being more of a guiding hand of, is the focus right? Is this sequenced correctly? Are you actually saying what you mean to say? Where's there some room for interpretation that might leave people with the wrong message? You know, it's a lot more of the organization and design of how you're structuring your writing than just, is the comma in the right place?
Yeah, exactly. One of my first gigs when I was fresh out of college, I was younger than Marty is now. I was working for a Games Workshop over in Nottingham and on a student work visa. And I ended up getting a book by John Blanche. He's one of their best artists over there, right? Just does some amazing stuff. And he had written the manuscript for his art book on, he had written it out by hand on vellum, which is tracing paper, right? And my job was to type it in, to transcribe it, and to edit it. And John was like this, you know, all this stuff looks like it's like hardcore death metal biker shit. And John runs around on a Harley and he's got a big beard and whatever. And I swear to God, he came up to me. He was just, you know, and I'm like 15, 20 years younger than him. And he comes up to me just terrified because he knows that I'm here to try to make, you know, edit his stuff. And I'm like, my job is not to make you look like an idiot. My job is to make you look the best you possibly can and to make your vision come true. Right. Yeah. And I've always taken that since then. And he was just the sweetest, kindest guy to me after that. And just, you know, and again, he was just really, you know, he had a great image as a hard ass, but he was really a sweet and sensitive artist as well. He just wanted to have people be able to appreciate him and his artwork for who they actually were and what he was doing. And try to strive with that every time I'm editing somebody, whether it's, you know, somebody like John or if it's Marty. I want Marty's stuff to be able to breathe and do its own thing. It's not my... If I commission that, I say, well, this is, you're going to write the back cover copy for this. That's one thing, right? Because it needs to be the back cover copy for this, right?
Yeah.
But if I'm saying, Marty, go off and do this stuff and make this adventure and make this character or whatever, fuck it. Run with it. Enjoy it. Have fun. Sorry, am I supposed to be swearing on this one?
Hey, who cares? Dude, seriously, this is Wargamers, man.
I was at drinking with authors just before this, so I've had a couple. And I'm like, oh, geez, I just slipped. So
dude, this is Wargamers, and probably 30 to 50% of our audience on any given episode is prior military. Really got to, like, work to offend
anybody. I'd have to go a long way to offend anybody.
Yeah, you've really got to work to it. We're going to dramatically expand Marty's vocabulary if he hangs out with us.
This is the part where Marty steps up and says, no, Dad, it wasn't like that at all. You fucked it over entirely.
Yeah. No, so, I mean, you were fine.
To be damned with such faint praise.
Yeah.
Oh, much sharper than a serpent's tooth.
Yeah, I mean, you know, some of the editors I met in college, they might have been a bit better, but might have edged you out a little.
I know where you live.
Here's the real question for Marty then. Did Dad wreck you for future role-playing and adventure gaming work? Or is this something that you've now got a taste of and it's in the blood, whether it's genetic or otherwise, that we're going to start seeing you on more credits?
No, I'd do stuff like this again. I don't have solid plans right now, but it wasn't a miserable experience.
Well, that resounding praise yet again.
Yes. Yeah.
Also,
I grew up in a home where damning with faint praise was basically the language.
Yeah.
Tiger, I don't really know what you're talking about.
So one question in this, you know, Matt, if you want to let Marty run with this or if
sure, go.
You want to take it. But so you'd originally done the Cypher system way back when. That's when we had first talked shotguns and sorcery. You've now rolled over to fifth edition. Was it simply because fifth edition, it's the biggest kid on the block, and so that's the widest possible audience you think you're going to get for it? is fifth edition just a great fit for the kinds of stories you're trying to tell, or like, did you lose a bet? Like, how did we end up with fifth edition as the system that you've run with? And, you know, was there ever any thought to like custom crafting its own, your own system to build off of, from, you know, for side, you know, Savage Worlds has been adapted to like pretty much right. anything that moves. I'm surprised there's not a Savage Worlds D&D adaptation out there, but
well, they did Savage Worlds Pathfinder, so that's pretty much the same thing, right?
I know. That's so yeah. you know, how did we end up with Shotguns and Sorcery for fifth edition specifically in all of this? And
well, whichever one this was to my decision. So I'll, if it's okay, Tiger, I'll take this one. But
yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Basically, this Shotguns and Sorcery started out as a third edition setting, right? Mm-hmm. And so for me, bringing it back to fifth edition was a natural thing to do, right? When I was coming up with everything for this, the back of my mind, I'm thinking, how do I meld this to Dungeons and Dragons? How do I make this an interesting, innovative, exciting version of Dungeons and Dragons? So when we moved over to the Cypher system, that was kind of interesting because like Marty said, some of these things, the books in the Cypher system don't really match up entirely because, again, I was thinking more of a D&D type thing when we first came up with. And then we melded over to the Cypher system. But coming back to fifth edition, it's like coming home in a lot of ways, right? Sure, it's the biggest kid on the block. Sure, it's probably the most money and certainly the largest audience for this kind of stuff. But, you know, there are other reasons to role-playing games. And we could have done Fate. We could have done Savage Worlds. We could have done all sorts of different systems. But it was just a natural thing to bring it back to fifth edition, I think, more than anything else. Yeah, over the years, I haven't done a whole lot of stuff for fourth or fifth edition for game design, but I've been writing stuff for Dungeons & Dragons. I wrote the Dungeonology book. I wrote a bunch of Endless Quest books, right? And I've written tons of stuff for third edition and second edition and whatever else. So for me, coming back to D&D was just a perfectly natural thing to do. I know a lot of guys have been doing this and having fun with it. And I'm like, well, let's do fifth edition and see if the audience for fifth edition is that larger for Cypher than it is for Cypher system. This is a very natural place to be for us. So
I notice you keep skipping right over fourth edition.
I taught Marty fourth edition. In fact, I wrote a series of articles for The Escapist about how I taught Marty fourth edition, him and his friends. He came over to our house and I taught them how to play D&D on fourth edition. And I actually like, okay, I'm going to write this up for The Escapist for how we did this. Fourth edition was a good version of the game, but I tell you, it was hard to run and hard to play if you did not have a computer with you, right? If you actually did not have the computerized software for generating characters, it was tricky. And I say that as somebody who designed a shitload of third edition characters where, you know, the math was just shy of calculus as far as where you needed to be with this stuff.
Yeah.
And the thing about third edition, the transition from second to third edition is second edition, like you could just make shit up, right?
Yeah.
Third edition, there was always a right answer, right? If you did things wrong, people would call you. They'd say, well, no, if you actually add up the fifth edition or the third, if you add up the sorcerer for three levels this way and the wizard for three levels this way, it actually comes out to this. And because there's an actual right mathematical answer. Third edition was the first edition of D&D that was really mathematically rigorous for that kind of stuff. Fifth edition has gotten a little bit further away from that, where they're not quite so serious about the math. It's more about the play experience than it is about whether or not an engineer would fall in love with this game.
Yeah. Right?
The third edition was a game that engineers loved. Fourth edition was a game that was meant for Magic the Gathering and World of Warcraft players because it was what they call exceptions-based gaming, where you have your basic system and then everything else is an exception to it, same way as the Magic the Gathering cards are. And I think in that sense, it was a really successful design. And it led us to fifth edition. But I think fifth edition is honestly my favorite edition of all the version so far. I mean, even going back to White Box D&D. Marty, do you remember the first game you ever played of Dungeons & Dragons?
How could I ever forget? Are you kidding me?
Who did you play with? Do you remember?
Yeah. Played with Frank. What do you mean?
Frank who? Frank Mentzer.
Mentzer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mentzer.
We were at Gary Con 1.
Yeah.
And Marty was just
he pulled out plaques at the end.
What's that?
He pulled out plaques at the end.
He actually gave everybody a certificate right at the end.
Yeah.
We played through Palace of the Vampire Princess, I think it was, which was the first ever published Dungeons & Dragons adventure.
Yeah,
we played
Tower of the Vampire Princess.
Yep.
Yeah, with Frank Mentzer.
Exactly, and Frank ran it, and we each got our own certificate, and it was Marty's first experience ever playing D&D, ever, much less anywhere. I mean, it was his first convention at Gary Con 1, and we had a ball. And Frank just treated him like royalty. We had a great time, but you were the youngest player at the table. But it was you and me and Steve Sullivan and Frank Mentzer and a bunch of other fantastic people. We had a great time. Hopefully that hooked you very early on.
Yeah, that must have been what, like 10 years old?
Maybe, right? Or 10. I remember talking to Ryan Dancy, who was in charge of D&D at the time. I described him what had happened. He says, holy shit. Right? Does he have any idea what just happened to him?
Yeah. See, Marty's like, yeah, my dad dragged me into this D&D game with Frank Mensur. And half of our audience is going, holy shit, he played with Frank Mensur.
Yeah, no, it was great, right? It was a great game, and we had a lot of fun. And it was my honor to introduce Marty to this stuff. We played games at that convention and other Gary Cons. We brought him to we played the Village of Hamlet as a chainmail game with Jeff Perrin.
Yeah. Right?
And that
again,
was
just... I go back to, did you lose a bet?
No, it was fantastic. It was fun as hell. We played this on Dave Arneson's original table too.
Oh, wow. Right?
At Gary Con. It was just like the history involved in that. And again, Marty was probably too young to appreciate a lot of it, but I was like, this is cool. We actually played Dungeon with David McGarry on Dave Arneson's ping pong table. They had brought down to, it wasn't even Gary Con. It was the one that they did in Milwaukee for a number of years. That Harold Johnson ran. I can't remember the name of the convention now, but it was great fun. I was a guest of honor there. I brought the kids over there. They used to have a live robo rally where they actually programmed in actual robots. On the floor as well. It was just hilarious fun.
I don't want to start any sort of role-playing edition wars, but I'm one of those oddballs that I actually really enjoyed 4th edition. From the perspective of one of those Magic the Gathering World of Warcraft guys, like I've never played World of Warcraft on the computer ever. Like I topped out at like Warcraft 1 back in the mid 90s, you know, with playing just a limited bit on the computer. I'm not a big computer gamer is a big piece of it.
Right.
I really enjoyed 4th edition. Part of it was we had a really good group here locally that a bunch of us all worked together at our day job at the defense contractor where I was working. And so we would have twice a week, we'd sit down over lunch and we'd manage to get through one or two encounters within the lunch hour.
Oh, that's great.
It was a lot of fun. We had a really good DM, local dude here, guy named Chris Karen, give him a shout out. Guy's been a fantastic DM for the 20 plus years I've known him. And that's, you know, we used 4th edition because that was the new edition off the press at the time. And we had a blast doing it, but I fully recognize that I am in a very tiny minority.
Fourth edition was a game
that... edition of D&D. I'm still a Beckme hardcore enthusiast overall. Sure. I've got like multiple copies of the rule cyclopedia that I've had since the early 90s, but I enjoyed 4th edition, and I know that makes me a weirdo. So
no, it was a game that they had very specific design parameters for it. And I think the team that designed it knocked it out of the park. They hit every one of those to a T. They did a great job with it, right? And honestly, I think if they had managed to hold out to the point where we got actual play and everything else going on, that might be the edition that we're all playing today, right? 5th edition is a great version of it. I think it hews back a little bit closer to the original roots. Things like advantages, disadvantages, these are new things, but I think they were actually quite fun, innovative things to add to the game. But the trick with 5th edition really wasn't that it's the best design for D&D ever, but that it fits with the kind of style of play that people are using for online stuff, right?
Yeah.
For things like Critical Role and all of these other actual play stuff, it really fit well for that. And, I'm kind of stunned with how fantastically the game has grown over the last 10 years, right?
One of the things that I really think 4th edition D&D would have been a hugely successful role-playing game if it hadn't been called D&D.
Anybody else in the industry would have killed for the sales numbers they had, right?
Yeah.
They would have murdered everybody in their family and said, yeah, that's okay. This is a fair deal. Sorry, Marty, I didn't mean to actually bring that up again. But it's yes.
Jump in there, Marty. What were you gonna say?
Nothing. I can't get by a day in this place without patricide coming up.
It's this unspoken threat that hangs over us every day.
Yeah.
Somebody's been playing Crusader Kings a little bit too much on their computer.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
No, it's, I thought it was a great game. I actually enjoyed playing with Marty and with his friends, but it was, 5th edition, I really liked too. I think it's a good solid game. A lot of it's in the timing, right? And it was a different crew. It was Bill Slavisek's last game they did at TSR Wizards of the Coast before he moved on. Because he ended up losing his job at the end of all that. And Mike Merles took over at that point. I think Mike and his team did a really good job with developing fifth edition. And now that's moved on to other people. We got John Scott Tynes and Ray Winninger in charge of it, and Chris Perkins. Yeah. And I think they're carried the baton. Now they've announced a new edition of Dungeons & Dragons coming out in 2024, I guess, which they're just going to call D&D 50, right, for the 50th anniversary.
In theory.
It's basically just going to be a living game that they're going to update as they go, which, you know, honestly makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways. It's, you know, who wants to learn a new game every few years and have to throw away all the shit you've already bought? And most of the stuff they publish for the game is not evergreen stuff. It's like, these are, you know, you're going to go through this adventure. You're going to learn all this stuff here, and then you're going to move on to the next thing. Right. So to be able to,
is this the part where I get to bring up that the Wargamers have had living rules for most of their games for the last 20 years.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to go. Again,
hit GMT's website and pull up any of their games that have been in print for 10, 15, 20 years and download the PDF of the current rule book with the most recent errata and updates and changes in there. And that's a really big deal for a handful of things that have system rules, like Mark Simonich's X40 system, the Normandy 44, Ukraine 43. Like, there's a core rule set underneath all of these. And so whenever the new board game drops with the update to the rules engine underneath it, they go back and they update everything else. And so those PDFs have been living rules for 15, 20 years or more. There's a Twilight Struggle living rule book. You know, there's all of these things. MMP has kept the Advanced Squad Leader rule book going as a living thing forever. That's just normal. And again, it's one of those things where the Wargamers are kind of shrugging and going, hey, it's about time y'all caught up.
Yeah. Thanks for catching up, dudes. Right.
Yeah.
Blood Bowl did that. Blood Bowl had the living rule book for like 10 years. And the funny part is they only had a living rule book when the game was pretty much ignored by the major company, right? Like, Games Workshop is like, well, yeah, we'll sell this to you, but we don't really care about it, but we want you guys to have access to it, the hardcore fans. So we're going to have a living rule book that we're just going to update as a PDF. And every time we do it, we'll just update the number, the version number, and let you know what we've changed. And you can move on from there. You can play the old editions if you want to, but we think this is better, right?
Yeah.
And then when they come out with new editions of the game in print, which is not very often, then they update the whole thing. I think that's a great way to go, right? And why reinvent something just to reinvent it? Which is a lot of it used to be the theory was you would reinvent it because this is the way you get new players on board, right? It's like when Marvel Comics says, let's do a number one issue again. So everybody knows this is a good jumping on point, right?
Yeah.
But D&D now is at the point where it's so goddamn big. You're not so worried. And it seems like there's no way to stop it from growing. There's no reason to say, no, you can only come on every 5 or 10 years or so. Jump on now. You can jump on any point, right? And we'll have an onboarding system for you that will bring you right up to where we are now.
As Armchair Dragoons continue the 7th season of Mentioned in Dispatches, we need to take a moment to thank those Patreon supporters who pledged at the regimental patron level. So a special thank you to Patrick Mullen, Hethwill Wargames, Steelgrave, Mike Quigley, Staggerwing, Robert, Joseph Knoll, Treb Curry, Kevin Bertram, and Patrick Garrity for their support of Armchair Dragoons and helping us bring you the best wargaming content on the web. You can join our Patreon supporters at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
Well, and I think what's different for the role-playing games is because the rules are not static, but the rules are applicable across such a wide range of things that your jumping on point are some of the pre-generated adventures. Like, here's a new first level on-ramp for new players that you can keep the same rules in place and let's roll out some new first level modules every 5 years.
Right,
That still serves as an appropriate on-ramp for those guys.
Yep. Yeah. You can freshen that stuff and you can apply the stuff you've learned from the previous things. Right. I mean, D&D's got a new starter set coming out, I think, or either coming out or just came out too. And you're like, well, that's fantastic. Right. Because for one, that old starter set's been sitting around for 5-7 years. Why don't we have a new starter set where I can bring in new people, apply all the shit that we've learned since then, and, you know, get people into a new place with it. And the people who have already played the original stuff, they're already light years beyond that. They're not going to pay any attention to this.
Yeah.
But it's a great place for new players to come on. And if you just do that new starter set every 5 years or so, or even less,
that's and great. Me being the weirdo, I've got like every one of those starter sets over the years.
Yeah, exactly.
I think the starter sets are a blast to see how those on-ramps change over the years. And so I've got going all the way back to the Holmes Blue Book box. I don't have the box anymore, but going back to the old Holmes Blue Book, yep. I've got every one of the starter sets for either Beckme or the new editions of AD&D as they've come out. I've got all the starter boxes for that. I don't have like the weird one-off ones, like the Rick and Morty one or the Stranger Things one.
Right. But you know, I think the Rick and Morty one, the Stranger Things one that they did, that kind of stuff, that's really what taught them that they could get away with this.
Yes. Right?
Because they can get in a new audience with new stuff that's fresh, that you know they can bring it from a different angle even, and say, why do we need to sell them the old stuff? We can actually come up with a new product here that will sell shitloads to collectors, to people who want to buy everything. Maybe they're not going to play everything. And also have a fresh on-road for people to come in. I think that's great. It's an amazing strategy on their part. They're really doing well with that these days.
Part of it for me, you know, this goes back to sort of intersecting multiple lines of interest. You know, my academic background is in media and communication and journalism, but I've spent a bunch of time in the communication world looking at training and learning and ways in which you can use games for different kinds of training and learning applications. And so the ways in which games teach you to play the game is one of those things that I've always kind of cared about a lot. And so to go through and to see the evolution of sort of how we teach D&D, you know, here, Junior, here's your new box set. Go learn how to play this game. Isn't this cool? Grandma bought you a game for Christmas kind of stuff. And go figure it out for yourself. And how we teach people the new game as they go, I think it's kind of cool. I think there's some neat stuff there to it. And I like grabbing those starter sets as they come out for that reason.
Yeah, there's one edition back in the 80s. I remember it was like tab sections of it that were taken directly from teacher supplements from the 80s as well.
It was the big black box that came out in 91 or 92.
Yeah.
So the podcast people can't see this. I've got one on that shelf back there behind the lamp.
Cool. I remember Troy Denning working there trying to explain it to me. I'm like, that sounds just like the shit they were trying to pull on us in grade school. Okay. Yeah. You know,
but you know what?
You're trying to figure out how to teach people stuff. That's what you do. You take whatever
those dragon cards are still one of the best on ramps for 10 and 12 year old kids. Hand them the box. They've got the cards. It's pre-programmed. You learn one rule at a time as you're going through it. Here's how to move around and do these basic things as you slowly reveal the map. It was I've got all of these starter sets to compare to, and I'm telling you, they've had a hard time topping that over the years. And
it was a good one.
It's weird because it's not, you know, here's a rule book, go figure it out. And so it is a little weird for people, but I really think that was a great one to use. It's funny you bring that one up because to me, that's still one of the best out there.
You know? No, it was one that we're specifically looking at. How do kids learn how to do this stuff, right?
Yep.
And what's the best in education we can tap on and use that? We actually, Marty and I and the other kids played Wingspan recently, and they had an introductory set. The neat thing about it is they actually have an introductory pack now that comes with the latest edition of the game, where it basically runs you through the first two turns of the game, right?
Okay.
With like, they actually tell you, give these cards to player one, give these cards to player two, give these cards to player three, and then coach you through it. So it's almost like a choose your own adventure kind of thing when you're starting it out. And then, you know, so they hold your hand through the first round or two, and then you move on from there. I mean, it was really, really brilliant way to teach people how to play games. And then you could actually take those cards that they have and just shuffle them in with the rest of the cards. You have extra cards to play with. So I thought it was really well done. That's always one of the big cracks for games of any kind is how do you teach people how to play it? And then how do they, because especially with role-playing games, there's two functions in the rule book is one, teaching people how to play, and two, having as a reference once they're playing. Yeah. Right. Yep. And how do you satisfy both those things and not make it boring or useless for one or the other? Right.
Yeah.
Or difficult to absolutely. Use.
We've talked a bunch about sort of the development of the current Shotguns and Sorcery product, but for folks that don't know much about the setting itself and the backstory here, like we talked about this back in 2015 when you were doing that original Kickstarter. Marty, I don't know if you want to tackle this or if you want to throw it to your dad, but what's the core shtick of the story? Because when you hear shotguns, you're not thinking D&D with shotguns. So what's kind of the core shtick of the game world and the setting? And when people want to pick up the setting, what are they in for?
My father has a little bit more experience with it, given that he's been working on it.
I'm actually intrigued to hear from your mouth. This would be
interesting. Yeah. No, I'll give it a shot. So it's a bit of zombie apocalypse. It's a bit of neo-noir. It's a bit of sorcery magic. And it's a bit of rootin' tootin' gun shootin'. It's set on a sort of nebulous sort of in a nebulous sort of space. It's set on a landmass that's called the continent. So it can slip sort of into empty spaces in anyone's pre-existing campaigns, because most of the adventuring in the city in this setting is supposed to take place in one city. Okay. It's supposed to take place in Dragon City. Like the novels are all about the city, and they're named after the city. It's about a city that is tiered based on class and race. It's surrounded by zombies. The zombies crawl over the walls, and there are guardsmen set up to take them out regularly. And the city is ruled by a giant red dragon who the townspeople have made a deal with to protect them from the encroaching zombie hordes. And in exchange, the dragon emperor gets to hoard their wealth and set up this sort of hierarchical system and be in charge and everything. And yeah, it's pretty neat. I like it.
I'm glad to hear you like it. It's funny watching you do this, because what happens, I've done this, like, I can't tell you how many countless times over the years, but you start getting a handle on it. You're like, I have to explain this to somebody. And you start developing a spiel, right?
Yeah.
And it's essentially what you're doing here. And it's just seeing the genesis of this, because you're going to end up doing this at Gamehole Con quite a bit over the next weekend. So by the end of the show, you're going to be like, and there you go.
You'll get your patter
down, right?
Yeah, I'm working on it. I've never had to sell this to anybody before.
Yeah, no, you'll enjoy it. It's interesting to sit down and say, and let me explain to you why this is so fucking cool, right?
Yeah.
It's funny. I don't remember who I was talking to. It wasn't Jeff Tidball, but it was somebody like him who's been around the industry forever. We were just chatting in an Origins. This is probably like 3 or 4 years ago. We were talking about sort of kind of being able to rattle off that spiel at a game convention and going through this thing so much that it almost becomes unconscious.
Yeah.
And I wish I could remember who it was, because I want to credit them for this. They said, honestly, some of the best people you could ever get to work a game convention booth for something like this are people that had worked as waiters and waitresses. Because they have those spiels down. It doesn't take them very long to memorize it. They've got it. They can rattle it off. They can do it in their sleep, literally. And they just know it so well that they can just flood it out there and make it sound natural without having to think too much about it, without having to remember too much about it. They just, they can absorb it and go as quick as possible.
Right.
They said, you know, that's really, they're serving product to the audience. That's what we need working booths. And he said, unfortunately, everybody that you can get who's a waiter or waitress can't afford to come to the game convention. They got to be home working. So
that's funny. Ross Isaacs, who's a great game designer, is actually a top level waiter in New York City, right? Like,
oh, wow.
Works fine dining and stuff like this. And when you say that, immediately makes me think of him, right? And today's special is, and then you just rattle it off and knows everything rock solid cold.
Yeah.
But this is the kind of thing you learn it usually under trial by fire at game conventions, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing it for decades now. So I develop the spiel as I go along and lean on old ones, but Marty, seriously, by the end of this weekend, you're going to know this shit down cold. And somebody says, so what's special about Shotguns and Sorcery? Sell me on it. You're going to be like, boom. And the neat thing is you'll actually start triggering in on the individual you're talking to, right? Like you'll say, oh, this guy cares about mechanics. This guy cares about story. This person here cares about this, right? And you will, you know, target in on the things that are most important to them, especially if you've just run a demo with them, right?
Because
you get to know people over the course of that and learn what they're excited about, and what's intriguing to them.
So one of the things with Shotgun and Sorcery, though, I mean, this all takes place within a city. So this is not a hex crawl. This is not exploring Terra Nova. This is, we've got a known defined environment, but there's a lot of crap happening within this known defined environment.
Right. I mean, although there's two options to it, right?
Yeah.
The entire area outside of Dragon City is like being destroyed by zombies constantly, even to this day, 500 years later.
Yes.
And so they have these old ruins. So once you've actually leveled up to the point where you think you can take on the zombies, you know, not get slaughtered immediately. You can wander out into the wilderness and try to explore the different ruins and try to see what's still there and try to grab treasure out of it. So there are lots of adventuring opportunities there, but there's the constant threat of the undead slaughtering you at any point.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
A lot of the major adventures are inside the city.
Yeah, the thing is, it's like this is post-apocalypse, right? But it's also supposed to be you're supposed to be able to slot it into whatever pre-existing thing you got. So it can't be both unless your pre-existing thing is also post-apocalypse. So it has to exist on a land mass that is either an island or it's somehow separated from the rest of your world by mountains or something. So we have there are within the book there are like suggestions within the old book and within the new book. There are things outside of Dragon City. But they are not the focus necessarily, but there are like wherever you're going to put this landmass, there will be stuff on it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you could basically take this in any part of a map that you have in your current campaign that says here there be dragons. You just change it to here there be zombies and boom, you just plop it down in the middle of that. Right.
Yeah.
There are bits in it where you can say you can actually take this and breathe life into it and make it your entire own setting if you want to.
Yeah.
You know, there's no reason not to, but if you want to adapt it into what you're already doing, because a lot of people have already been playing their D&D game for, you know, however many years.
Yeah.
And we want to, you know, cater to that as well. They can just put it in an area where it's like, holy shit, nobody ever goes there.
Yeah.
Now we know why. Right.
You know, certainly you're capable of leaving the walls and taking a chance out there and rolling the dice with the undead. But I think, you know, as conceptualized, this was intended to be a big urban fantasy story.
Right. Yeah, it's actually urban fantasy with the emphasis on the fantasy, right? Like, if you talk about urban fantasy in terms of genre, for literary genre, that tends to be modern stuff with vampires and demons and whatever else.
Yeah.
But this is urban in the sense you took a fantasy setting and you advanced it a few hundred years ahead of where it was, so that a lot of times the magic replicates the technology, right?
Yeah.
So there are glow globes when you walk into a room, you just tap something, the lights come on. If you want to hail a taxi, you just put up your hand and a flying carpet comes down and picks you up, right? Things like that. So if you can imagine Minas Tirith 500 years on, the low magic has actually managed to accrete to a point where it's become essentially technology for people. And they pretty much treat it the same way we treat technology, which is most people don't understand it, but there's a core class of people who do, who produce and maintain and everything else, right?
Yeah. I don't know how familiar Marty might be with this. Matt, you probably are at least passingly familiar. One of the things that comes to mind every time I come across Shotguns and Sorcery is the old John Ostrander Grimjack comic.
Oh, yeah, I love those comics. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one that always comes to mind. For whatever reason.
Yeah, definitely that kind of advanced fantasy stuff, right? I was writing about this the other day. You know, the thing that actually triggered me off was there was a game called Arcanum, which was a what do they call it when you have the, anyhow, it's a
isometric. I know exactly.
Isometric. Thank you. I always blow isometric.
That was a very late.
Marty knows I have a brain fart on isometric.
Yeah,
it was an isometric role playing game in the sense of like, you know, the old D&D games. But it was this kind of a steampunk fantasy thing. And when I saw some of the illustrations for it, I'm like, oh, there's a dwarf with a Tommy gun. That is so goddamn cool. I love that. And then the game itself didn't actually turn out to be what I wanted it to be, right? This is actually how a lot of things when you're creating stuff are. You don't often go out to set out to create something like, I'm going to do my version of Lord of the Rings. You don't do that stuff. You say, I want to do this thing. I love this idea. And there's nothing else there like it out there like it. So I need to go make it.
Yeah.
And that's why you do this. That's why you're like, well, there's nothing particularly like this out here. This is where the inspiration came from, but it's an entirely different thing. And it was, you know, the idea of dwarves with Tommy guns running around the city. And essentially this is if J.R.R. Tolkien and Raymond Chandler had been drinking buddies, right? And come together and come up with this story together. That's really where I wanted it to feel.
I'm going to pull something up on screen for you guys to see, and I'm going to end up posting this, attaching this podcast episode when we post this online. But it's the idea of wizards have the same trust in magic that software designers have in software, which is to say almost none at all.
That's kind of it, really, right?
This one is completely so. Again, my professional, you know, my academic background's a lot of comm and journalism kind of stuff. My professional background for the past almost 15 years, I've worked in the IT world as an analyst and project manager, and so I've been working with these guys that are the equivalent of the wizards in these things. You know, I was in the circle that made Alston's Divine Circle of Teleportation. There's some pretty nasty corner cases you can get into, but the headmaster published it without us. I just take ships. It's way safer. If you've ever hung around software designers for very long, you recognize exactly what is being described here.
Yeah. No, it's the idea that the stuff has been advanced to a certain point where, you know, most people don't want to deal with it. There's an academy that deals with this shit. There's the Academy of Arcane Apprentices that does this kind of stuff. And they teach, and Max Gibson, who's the hero of the novels, is like a dropout from this because his dad was part of it and part of the establishment. He didn't believe in it. So he's gone on to do his own thing where he's like, fuck you, dad. I'm going to go rob tombs for a living.
Yeah.
And then it all goes bad and he's stuck in the city. And
the wizard in your book is basically a drugged up psycho.
Yeah, well, that's kind of how I live my life. You know how it is.
are we writing to what we know here, Matt?
I'm just going to sip my Lafrag here and not answer that question.
Shotguns and Sorcery book is dropping on Kickstarter. When are we going to see the fifth?
It's going to start out on October 26th. So we're going to launch on October 26th.
Okay, and so that's shortly after this podcast is going to hit live. That people
exactly.
Will
so
see
if people
it.
Are interested, you go to Shotguns and Sorcery, you know, the N instead of and. And that'll actually redirect you to the pre-launch page for the Kickstarter. That okay. means that the moment the Kickstarter launches, when I go and, you know, go and punch that big green button and launch the whole thing, you'll get an email saying, hey, buddy, you were interested in this. Come on over and join the fun. So go ahead and sign up for the pre-launch. You know, getting early backers and getting people excited about the game early on and funding very quickly is one of the great things for building momentum for these kind of things. And then we can get lots more people on. We can do stretch goals. We can get make it a much better game, much better books with all sorts of cool stuff on them. So please, if you can get on there on day one, better yet, day two is okay too. If you sit around and say, well, let's wait till day 25, and we'll say, well, it's only a 3-week drive, dude. You missed it.
Yeah.
Because actually, we're ending on October 26th. We're starting on October 26th. We're ending on November 16th. So it's only a 3-week drive, right?
Net.com.
What's that?
ShotgunsInSorcery.com.
Thank you.
.com. Okay.
We've got the link right below.
Well, Frank has been talking
right here
to
with the podcast
too.
Episode, thank you, so people can click on that and go hit it.
But you know, the trick is that we're actually at one point I was going to launch it like tomorrow, and then I'm like, well, too much is going on. I'm not going to be able to do this. Let's bump it off a week. Most of the times in the middle of a Kickstarter, like the 2 weeks in the middle are just this dead period. You're like in the doldrums, and nothing happens, and we're all sitting there going, Jesus Christ, what's going to happen? So I figured we cut out one of those weeks.
Because we'll everybody that really wanted it jumped on it the first week, and they were in no matter what. And then you've got everybody that's waiting until the last minute to see what stretch goals you hit.
Exactly. So don't wait. Jump on early. We appreciate – honestly, I appreciate if you do it. It's I would take it as a personal favor if you jumped on early because that gives us the confidence to keep going. Right.
Matt just really wants to be able to put the whole funded in 24 hours.
You know, I just think it's cool. I mean, it gets people excited about it, gets more people involved. And the more people involved we can get, the more fun it's going to be. I don't know if you guys saw it, like, what the hell was Rob Davio's latest thing? It was Thunder Road, right? The Kickstarter last Monday, and then they canceled it because they didn't hit their previous goals. Jordan Weissman did the same thing with his latest game. I can't remember the name of it again, but it was from Guildhall Studios, which did the Pirates game that they did before that. They're doing another game, and the marketing wasn't in place. It didn't quite strike off the way they wanted it to. And they ended up canceling the game and saying, we're going to do this. You know, we're going to reboot. We're going to do it a few months from now. I would rather not reboot. I'd rather have everybody excited the first day. if we have to reboot, we'll reboot. But I'd rather have everybody excited the first day and just get in and go. Honestly, I'm going to make this goddamn thing either way, right? Marty's already done the writing. We got all the artwork in there. I've got a little bit of extra writing to do myself. and it's coming out, right? This, whether or not everybody backs or not, we're coming out with a goddamn thing.
Yeah, basically just taking pre-orders at this point.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. We're taking pre-orders. But again, the trick about this is that we're not planning to sell this in stores. We're not planning to go through distribution and everything else. So if you're planning to see this at a convention or at a game store in the near future, your chances are very low of that happening. Right. If you want this book, if you want to see it happen, if you want to be one of the people who gets on the ground floor, the Kickstarter is really the only way to get it. Right.
For like, I'm not trying to make that as a threat. It's actually just, for the two people that own game stores that are listening to us, is there like a game store package that folks can order and get like 5 or 8 copies of?
Now, I've been debating about that. I've been thinking about it. And if I haven't put it on the Kickstarter yet, but if somebody wants to order a certain number of copies, I will give them the traditional 50% off. And, you know, we'll figure out who, I'm not sure if they're going to do shipping or I'm going to do shipping. Probably if they're in the US, I'll do shipping. Right. But if they want to order a certain number of copies, I would be happy to give them a discount and let them sell them in stores. Right. But again, don't bank on your store being one of the few that's going to pull this off, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally.
I mean, I love game retailers. One of my old college roommates is a game retailer, runs I'm Bored up in Madison, Brian Winter. Shout out to Brian if you're listening. I'm a big fan of game stores. They've supported me throughout the years. But I know how many game stores are selling third-party D&D things, right? It's just not that many. And for me to try to push all this
stuff. Are you telling people not to send us money?
What's that?
Are you telling people not to send us money?
I'm telling them not to worry. It's not going to show up in their game store. Send the money to us.
Not to filter it through the retail store.
Yeah.
Send the money straight to you. Don't launder it.
If it shows up at a game store, it's because you have a really freaking awesome game store company, your local friendly local game store that believes in this kind of stuff. And if that's the case, support them. But ask them ahead of time to make sure they're doing it. Okay. if you don't have 100% confidence in that, buy it through us, and we'll get one shipped directly to your door. We have Atlas Games is going to be doing our fulfillment. They're fantastic people. Yeah. John and Michelle Nephew up there are going to be sending your books out. We got printers lined up. We got artists all done. This is a thing that just needs essentially the Kickstarter to fund and then to close. And then we start moving stuff out towards it.
Yeah. So Marty, here's a question for you on Kickstarter. What I don't know how many Kickstarter things you might have backed out there in the last couple of years. What's the coolest thing you've seen come across Kickstarter so far?
Well, I thought the Rob Davio thing was all right, but that fell through.
The Thunder Road. But, you know, he did Dark Tower. He did, Rob's done a shitload of
old Hasbro games. You were talking to me about it the other day. That's why I got him confused with Schwab.
Exactly. Yeah. Hey, we're about to do Game Hole Con, too. And the last time I saw Rob, it's at Game Hole Con. So
that might be that was embarrassing.
You've never met Schwab, though, have you? So we'll have to fix that at some point, too.
No, not face-to-face. I really should.
He's a great goddamn guy.
I don't know. I don't browse Kickstarter that much.
Marty, I backed like 300 Kickstarters, and Marty's like, "What'd you back this time?" So
yeah. This guy's the money man. He comes in with a stack of board games every 6 months. He's like, "Look what I found on the internet."
What's the coolest package that you've backed off of Kickstarter yet so far?
Man, the coolest one I'm looking forward to right now is the Car Wars 6th Edition. Right.
Yeah.
Because Marty and I played it at Gen Con.
Yeah, we demoed that at Gen Con for like a solid 40, 50 minutes. It's really good.
Yeah. And I played the original game and it was in Ziploc baggies. Right. Yep. So that to actually be able to play with plastic freaking miniatures and the these wheels that actually tell you everything you need to know, the display wheels, whatever. It's amazing. It looks great. And we actually got to play with the designer whose name escapes me at the moment, but. Yeah. It was a lot of fun, right? I'm really looking forward to that. And we backed for the 4-player game. And I'm like just waiting for this gigantic freaking box to show up on my doorstep and then go, okay, where do I put this until we can play it? And, you know,
You're going to hear a forklift backing into your driveway to deliver that one.
No, it's going to be fun. The previous ones, I backed the first Reaper Miniatures Kickstarter when they were doing that shit. Holy shit. We could have been painting those things for years.
Yeah, we still got boxes of those lying around.
I'm totally – the problem with the Reapers ones is they always seem to come out when, like, I'm between jobs or there's some major travel coming up, and I don't have the $100 to drop on one of these. Yeah. I've already warned my wife, like, the next one of these big Reaper campaigns that comes out, I'm dropping the $100 on it or whatever. I swear to God, those guys get to a certain point where they just walk into the warehouse and go, okay, what do we got that we can throw on as a stretch goal? Because we're out of stuff to invent, right? You know,
right.
What's on hand that we can just tack on?
I think I gave out the first Shotguns and Sorcery book as a stretch goal for the first Reaper Miniatures thing, right? Really? That was me just basically thanking Ed
for
having gotten me started writing novels, right? I told the story in the last podcast. It was just on, but Ed, I was writing all sorts of games over the years, and I wanted to write novels, and I approached Wizards of the Coast, or TSR back in the day, and Games Workshop, and said, "You guys have novel divisions. I've written millions of words for you. Why don't you hire me to write a novel?" They're like, "Well, because you've never written a novel." I had one I wrote in college that was terrible, that Marty glanced at and had to wash his eyes.
Oh, man, I've read the first couple chapters of that thing. Yeah. I don't know how many times. It's so good.
One of these days,
I'm going to steal it out from under you, publish it under another name.
I have to wait till I die to publish that, okay?
Listen, I know it says in your will that it's supposed to be burned, but I'm taking it. It's getting
out.
He's
just going to put it out there as M4Back and hope nobody knows.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh my God, I'm not publishing that with anybody. But anyhow,
beautiful piece.
So I was going to show that to guys at Games Workshop and Wizards of the Coast, but they're like, "Well, until you can prove to us you can write a full novel, we can't hire you." Right. So I was bitching about this at some convention, and Ed Pugh leans over and he heard me. He goes, "Matt, you haven't written a novel yet?" He's like, "Nah." I explain it to him. He's like, "I'll hire you to write a novel." Well, Ed, I will write your novel then. Right? So he had me write a novel for Cav, their combat assault vehicle, which is their big mech game, right? Mech fighting game. And it was Marty's uncle, Nick Kalinske. I used him as the name for the main character throughout the whole thing. And it was basically this fighting mech tournament, like the NCAA tournament. And I wrote this thing. It was 40,000 words. I sent it out to Ed. He FedExed me a check before he even opened up the goddamn file, right? He was just that much of a quality guy. And then the book was out like 5-6 months later. He just, because, you know, they're not a traditional publisher. Like, "We got a manuscript. Let's put it in print." And I turn around, I showed it to the guys at Workshop and TSR, and they're like, "Let's talk." And literally, I signed novel contracts with both of them within a couple months of that.
Wow.
And it was really because Ed had faith in me for that. So
Ed gave you the start.
Yeah. So when they were doing the Reaper's Miniature thing, the first one, I'm like, "Ed, what can I throw at you to help out?" I'm like, "Have a copy of Shotguns and Sorcery." I think it was that. It was one of my books. I think it was Shotguns and Sorcery. I'm like, "This is a fantasy novel. It'll fit well with your guys. Take that and run with it." So I was thrilled.
No, that's
a minor thank you. I owe that dude.
So one other off the wall kind of question for you. Matt, you've seen a crap ton of games in your day. Marty, you've seen a crap ton of your dad's games in your day. Marty, what's the worst game you've ever sat down to try to play?
Oh, man.
That's a loaded question, Tiger. I'm just going to warn you from here.
just curious. Matt, same question, Matt. Like, what's the worst game you ever sat down to try to play that just did not click? And look, this doesn't mean that the game necessarily completely sucks. It just bounced
right,
off
right.
you.
It just doesn't
it wasn't
work for
something
you.
That was fit right. for you. And that's totally cool. Like, somebody else might – it might be their favorite game of all time, but – I'm curious, you know, Marty, what's the worst thing you've ever sat down to play before? And Monopoly is
a cheap answer. Monopoly is a cheap answer. Monopoly is a cheap answer.
Monopoly is the go-to for every hobby game player.
Yeah.
What was that
for a board game? What was that Cthulhu Arms game?
Oh, yes. I remember what you're talking about.
That was miserable.
That was a friend of mine who designed that, so I'm not going to name it.
Okay. Yeah. I thought you might say that. That was fine. I didn't say that.
It was an atrocious game. You're right. It was not very good. I actually had the same question in the last podcast I did. They were asking me about what's the book you hated the most, right?
Yeah.
I'm like, you know what? I have a strict policy against slagging other people's work in public, mostly because I know exactly how much of work goes into it. I know exactly how much heart goes into it. And just because it's not for me, I'm not going to rip on it. However, I'll make exceptions for very large games that I think suck. Right?
Yeah, like, it is Monopoly. I'll
make an exception for Monopoly, which just is a shit
that's
game.
That's not an exception. That's the standard answer for everybody in the hobby.
Well, the funny part is Monopoly is probably the best-selling board game of all time, right? Maybe the best-selling game of all time.
Yeah, and it's the least played, you know, in ratio to how many copies it's sold. But
I ended up talking to Mike Gray, who was the director of game acquisition at Hasbro. He's a friend of mine for many years. He worked at TSR, and I used to be on panels with him at Gen Con all the time. And he said their market research indicated that most of their games were purchased by older female relatives, like aunts, grandmas, whatever, for children usually, right, for younger relatives
as gifts. Yeah.
As gifts that were then played an average of less than once.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm like, my heart. Yeah. What do you do with that information, right? Like, yeah, if you're the person who put on your
heart, they've got your money. At that point, yeah, they don't care how many times you play it. They got your money. Who cares?
Exactly. And honestly, I mean, the whole story behind Monopoly, I had a friend who actually wrote a whole book about Monopoly. And it was about Lizzie McGee, who originally came off the landlord's
game,
that was then stolen by a dude named Darrow, who then turned around and sold it to Parker Brothers, who then denied that it had been Lizzie's game forever, because they said it was some kind of just a public game that people were playing or whatever, a traditional game. And she did a great job writing. I think the book is called The Monopolist, and a great book about this terrible history where Parker Brothers just basically ignored it for decades until they realized they had to pay the lady off.
Right? Yeah. Monopoly is bad.
Mary Pilon wrote the book, P-I-L-O-N. She's great.
The original version of the landlord game is rather good. So
I mean, the funny part about the landlord game is it's actually designed to teach you about the evils of capitalism and how terrible it is when people just abuse it, right? In that sense, Monopoly is a huge goddamn success.
It's
it teaches you that the person in charge, the person in the lead, is going to maintain the lead and grow the lead without any effort on their own part and beat the shit out of everybody else. Now, that may be true as far as a lesson goes, but it's a really shitty game.
Yeah, the only way it can be more appropriate is if the board burned down at the end.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, it's just so terrible. I mean, it's got this thing called a snowball effect in it, right? Which is the opposite of a lot of games. We have what are called rubber banding or catch-up effects, where the person behind, you give them advantages so they can actually, you know, have a chance of winning the game,
at competitive,
or at least being in competition, right? But in Monopoly, being in the lead gives you extra advantages. So the chances, once you actually take the lead, of losing the lead are about zero.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and one of the other problems you run into with Monopoly is not just sort of that runaway effect. Like the Carcassonne games are a great example of this, with the end of game scoring in addition to the during game scoring. That one of the things that I've always emphasized to people when I'm teaching them some of these Euro games and kind of contrasting them with the more traditional American style games that they're used to, that a lot of them grew up with, like there's no elimination mechanic in most Euro games. And so everybody's around the table the whole time. And the key point that I bring up to folks is you might be hopelessly behind. You're not necessarily going to be in a position to win, but you may be in a position to determine who wins by doing something that pushes somebody else ahead or help inadvertently or intentionally. You may end up making the decision that decides who wins through your own action or inaction that never would have come to pass if you got knocked out of the game on turn four and like you're watching the game on TV while everybody else finishes.
Right. Exactly. You're not the king now, you're the king maker, right?
Yeah.
That can be an exciting position to play.
Yeah.
So that's
completely absent Monopoly.
Yeah, exactly.
You're right. Yeah. You're right. Yeah. It is. Yeah. Absolutely, Marty. And, you know, in terms of games that just kind of bounced off of people, the one that I always come back to that I just could not stand, and if anybody ever asks to play, I'm leaving the room. I hated Colosseum. Colosseum. Could not stand it. This whole, hey, let's put on a show, and here's a handful of resources you got to kind of collect, but, you know, the catch-up mechanism is basically, oh, you have to give that other guy some resources. Why? Well, it's a game balance thing. Like, there's no narrative reason for that to happen. No actual, like, craft behind, you know, trying to produce these shows to attract audiences. It's just sort of collect the right tokens for the play you're trying to perform. And it's boring. It takes too damn long. There's no real player interaction. Everybody's playing parallel games. They just happen to be sitting at a table together. And really the only interaction is, oh, I have to give you something to be nice to you because you suck at what you're doing so far. And it's just, it's a bad game. I can't stand it. It hits all the wrong notes for me. And other people love it. Fine. Go play it. I'm not coming anywhere near your table as long as you are.
No, I totally understand that. You know what? Again, it's if they love it, there are people who love Monopoly, right? I know people who just adore the game, right? I'm like, well, I know never to sit down at a table with you again. Then.
Those people are weird.
Yes, exactly. And let me introduce you to some better games, hopefully, in your life, right? There are a lot of other options out there. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, if you're having fun with the people you're playing with, have fun, right? Not my business. I'm not going to step in here and tell you you're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
I might say, let's try this instead later. But meanwhile, if you're playing that game, enjoy it.
So, Marty, what's up for you next in the game world after Shotguns and Sorcery gets to print here? Any idea?
You already got three more contracts. I have up? No solid plans. No.
Yeah. No. Tell me what you want to do.
What?
You have to tell me what you want to do.
Oh, yeah.
So you guys all heard it here first. Noted game designer Marty Forbeck is a free agent and looking for work.
Yeah.
You can contact me nowhere. Don't come looking for me. You can't find me.
Playing hard to get. That's how it took me a while to land him, I have to say.
I'm not active on social media. You can't find me on Twitter. You definitely can't find me on Facebook. Don't find me. But I will take your jobs.
So don't find Marty. He will find you.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then you'll have to let him work for you. That's how it works.
So Matt, what's next for you after? Obviously, you've already got other work lined up, but what's the next thing you're looking forward to tackling?
I'm currently working on two different video games and the Marvel tabletop role-playing game known as the Marvel Multiverse role-playing game. Okay. And that's we're doing a playtest edition that's going to be coming out in the spring of 2022, and then in 2023 we're going to come out with the full-on game. So
if folks want to get involved with the playtest, how do they find that?
Well, what's going to happen is there's going to be a book available for $10 for a 104-page comic book size book, trade paperback type thing. It comes out in supposedly the end of March, maybe early April, in next year. And you'll be able to purchase that, and then you'll be able to contribute to the playtest that way, right?
Okay.
And then when the full game comes out, that's going to be like, you know, your $50, $60 hardcover book, whatever. And that'll come out in the year 2023, where we're going to take and incorporate a lot of the playtesting experience we have from the playtest book. The reason we did this is that the basic system is pretty solid, but honestly, designing all the different power systems for each different type of character is a whole different game every time, it seems like, right? And watching them interact with each other is the kind of thing that you can really only do in the market. It's not something we could possibly pull off with everybody around a table. I can't do this with my family. I can't do this with my friends. Can't even do it at conventions with hundreds of people. We need thousands of people to be involved with this kind of things, which is the reason we're going to be doing it on the market, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. It's almost like the Steam early access where people.
That's very much like what it is, right? And we're going to be relying on players to help us out and contribute whatever they can. Obviously you're pitching in $10, whatever, which is a goddamn cheap price for a great role-playing game. But you're going to be pitching in a few bucks in some of your time. And we'd love to hear from people about what they think about these various pieces that we're presenting to them and tell us how much we suck and how we can be better.
That's how you get better. Like, you don't fix things by people telling you how great they are.
Now, you cannot have a thin skin about this stuff. I've learned that a long time ago. You have to be willing to listen to people. And some of them, if they're assholes that are just telling you suck for fun, then, you know, that's one thing. But most people actually step up and do this stuff are actually like, I didn't like this because. And then you have to listen to them and say, okay, is this a good reason? Is this something I can solve? Is this a solvable problem? And can I come up with a way to fix that and make it better for them and for the people around them? I think that's invaluable, right? I really appreciate everybody who contributes in that level.
Yeah, absolutely. There's nothing like a blind playtest to tell you.
Oh, it's fantastic, right? And most of the time in the past, we had to just put the stuff out here and then people tell us we suck in various other ways. So it's kind of nice to be able to say, hey, we have this period to tell us we suck. And after that, you got to shut up. No, you keep talking after that, but at least at that point, you'll have had your chance to put in your nickel's worth. And,
at this point, it only costs you $10 to tell us we suck instead of the $60 down the line.
Later on, you have to spend in a bit more money. You'll tell us we suck either way. We know. You know, if you steal the game, you'll tell us we suck. It works out.
They're gamers. They gripe. That's what they do.
But hopefully a lot of y'all have fun because that's really the whole point. And I'm sure most people do play these things.
Cool. Well, look, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. I'm going to go watch and see if the Astros can catch up with the Red Sox here. They're getting pummeled again.
Good luck.
I appreciate you guys taking the time, especially Matt pulling double duty here with multiple podcasts in one night. We've got the...
It's been really hard to drink all afternoon.
It's terrifying. You know, the sacrifices you make for this craft. Okay.
Yeah. It must suck to have to sit there and pound beers while podcasting.
Oh, it's just, you know, it's I do it for love. That's all it is.
So we've got the link to the Kickstarter here on the podcast page. So folks, make sure you hit that. If you want to chuckle at the wizards as software developers, that's right down there below as well. that you'll be able to get a laugh out of that. It is, as Matt noted, it's a very quick Kickstarter, so it's a pretty short notice one. So if you took your time and decided to binge these podcasts all at once at the end of the season, too late. You missed your chance. You should have been listening to us all along. But the rest of y'all that are listening as we go, go jump on the Kickstarter. Throw Matt and Marty a couple of shekels. Help Marty's first big game production here sell out and go great guns. And come join us next time for our next episode of Mention and Dispatches, where we're going to be talking about the Compass Games catalog for this coming year. Yes, we're doing the Compass Games catalog again. By getting our butts chewed about it last time, that's never stopped us. We're totally doing this again this year, and we hope you join us for a supersized podcast for that one. Gentlemen, thanks and good night.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Wonderful.